Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so week one of the college football season is finally over. Man, that was some kind of week, wasn't it? In fact, it was a great week because it ran nearly an entire week. From Thursday to Monday. Now it seems to be weird to be here on a Tuesday and not see a college football game tonight. I mean, I was starting to think that there was a game every single day of the season in college football. Because, man, there were so many moments over the weekend. Lots of moments. Great moments. Starting with a guy who got some serious jungle karma. Did we or did we not put him on the show last week? Did he or did he not go out and shock a former assistant? You know who I'm talking about. Mack Brown. Mack Brown did his former assistant, Will Muschamp, in his first game back in North Carolina. And then after it happened, he got real. Real emotional.
Allison just proud of the guys. These guys have had a tough time, and we worked really hard. We made so many mistakes. Oh, my God. And for them to win this game is such a great win for those kids, our coaching staff, and these fans, because they've waited for this a long time.
I feel you, Mac. I feel you. Congrats. Now you know why he came back. I mean, I'm sure that he would have said, and he said things like this when I spoke to him prior to that game, those are the types of things that he was coming back for. That's why you come out of retirement. That's why you leave that cushy TV job for moments like that. I'm just not so sure that even Mac knew he'd have moments like that his first game back. So already that's paying great dividends. Or how about Jonathan Taylor in Wisconsin rolling over South Florida, 49-0 on the road. I saw that game. Surrounded by Badger fans in Madison. That was one hell of an experience. Get ready for a hell of a lot more of that because that's a special player. And he's as good in the locker room and off the field as he is on the field. And he's a leading Heisman candidate on the field. Now, I know that everybody's going to want to jump to conclusions after only 1 week. Just know that there's nothing more tired than doing that. There's nothing more overplayed than watching 60 minutes of football and then saying that Clemson is going to repeat or that Alabama is rejuvenated and reinvented itself and they're back or that Michigan is finally living up to all the hype because they beat Middle Tennessee. Don't do that. You can never read that much in one game. Then again, if you're the Pac-12, it's getting kind of hard not to, right? And being that I honk for things like that, it's hard for me to own that, but I will. I mean, forget reading too much into one game for one team. How about the entire conference? Everybody knew the pressure that was on Oregon going into that game against Auburn. A lot more pressure on Oregon than Auburn going into that game because they were not just playing for themselves. They were playing for the entire conference, and they showed up. They showed up well. They showed up well until the very end.
16 seconds in the fourth. Nix steps up. He throws to Williams. He's got it. Touchdown, Auburn. Touchdown, Auburn. Bo Nix to Seth Williams.
Wow.
With 9 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter.
Now it'd be a good time to say War Eagles Radio Network. Because that's where the war started. And that was brass by Bo Nix, a freshman, and an absolute dagger to the chest, not only for Oregon, but for the entire Pac-12. And again, it wasn't just Oregon. UCLA did not make things any better by starting off that weekend with a loss to Cincinnati. USC, although they got by Fresno State, lost quarterback JT Daniels. In the process, an enormous blow. But even more than people jumping to conclusions about a team or a conference after one game is people jumping to conclusions about the entire sport after one game and wanting to give out the Heisman on Labor Day weekend. But that said, did you see Jalen Hurts? I mean, did you see Jalen Hurts? This guy transfers to Oklahoma in the spring. He wins the job. He comes out in his first game, and he has a career-high 508 offensive yards and 6 touchdowns against Houston. 6 touches. This guy arrived on campus like, what, 10 minutes ago? Gets out of the car and immediately starts slinging it all over the joint.
Snap to Jalen Hurts. Wants to throw, does across the middle. Rambo first down into Houston territory. Splits defenders, 30. It's a race, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown! Charleston Rambo draws first blood second half.
Listen, I understand that Houston's defense does need some work, but that did not look like a guy playing his first game for a new team with new teammates and a new head coach. Actually, the question should not be, did you see Jalen Hurts? But rather, did you forget about Jalen Hurts? Because it feels like a hell of a lot of people did, right? Lest we forget, the guy was 26-2 as a starter at Alabama. He was the SEC Offensive Player of the Year as a freshman. He did lead them to back-to-back national title games. I'm not saying you give Hurts the Heisman. I'm not saying that. I'm saying give it to his coach, Lincoln Riley. And then Riley can give it to whoever the hell he wants. Remember when Baker Mayfield won it in Riley's first season? Everybody said, that's pretty cool. Yeah, let's see if the guy can do it again. Riley, I mean. Or is he just a one-hit wonder? And then Kyler Murray wins it last year. And then the same people say, yeah, that's pretty cool. Maybe lightning does strike twice. Or maybe Riley is just really fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. Twice. You know, some dudes are just lucky like that. Hey, look, me, I'm not saying that at all. I've never said that about this guy. I'm not saying that, but a lot of you were. So what happened? Hurts comes in, absolutely lights the joint on fire. Proving one thing, there's nothing lucky about this. Other than being the guy lucky enough to play quarterback for Riley. Because right now, if you're the starting quarterback in Norman under Riley, you're going to win the Heisman Trophy. But even above and beyond that, there are two moments that really stuck out from that first weekend. One that I'm going to get into right now, and one that deserves its own take. The team of the week for week one. And by the way, can I just interrupt this thought for a minute? How good is it to have college football back? It's so good. So good. Even if you had Notre Dame last night minus 19 and they won by 18. I digress. I didn't say I did. I said even if you did. Oh! No, the team of the week. The team of the week for week one, Georgia State. Could not wait to talk about these guys. A program that started in 2010. A program that went 2-10 last year. They were paid 950 GER to show up in Knoxville and get their asses kicked by Tennessee. Except nobody told the Panthers that because they went into Neyland Stadium and they stunned the Vols 38-30. Tennessee was a nearly 4-touchdown favorite, paying out nearly a mil to bank that win. And they got worked. I'm not saying that this is on par with, say, App State beating Michigan, because nothing is. But this is clearly in the running for most embarrassing moment in Vols history. And there have been some pretty embarrassing moments in Tennessee football over the past two decades. I don't know, the Lane Kiffin era, the Derek Dooley era, the Brady Hoke era. But as bad as the shower discipline was under Dooley, and as stupid as the turnover trash can was under Butch Jones, Saturday was so much worse. And don't get this part twisted, right? There was nothing weird or fluky or wacky about that. Georgia State did not get lucky. They got nice. They got over. They were the better team. They punched Tennessee in the face repeatedly. They took the 950 grand and they went home with a W as well. Head coach Sean Elliott and his team absolutely humiliated the Vols in their own house. And nothing summed it up better than two volunteer defensive players taking each other out while Panthers quarterback Dan Ellington ran for a fourth quarter TD.
Carter goes in motion off the center. He'll hand off to Barnett. No, Ellington keeps it. Puts his foot to the ground. Gets ahead for the first down. Slips away. Touchdown. Beautiful run for the quarterback, Dan Ellington.
Man, that is so good. So funny if you saw that, if you're watching on CBS Sports Network. But not good for Tennessee. In fact, bad. How bad? Here's some adjectives from Tennessee players after the game. Quote, flabbergasted. quote, disgusted. Hate to say it, fellas, but there's no reason to be flabbergasted. That was a beating that you had coming to you. Georgia State manhandled Tennessee, and if the Vols couldn't see that coming, that's on them and nobody else. And they obviously didn't see it coming because they took the field unprepared. And nobody enjoyed that more than Sean Elliott's old boss, the old ball coach, Steve Spurrier. He told Andy Staples, quote, "They just thoroughly beat Tennessee. It wasn't any fluke. There weren't any fluky plays. They were 26-point underdogs. Isn't that right? Rocky top might be rocky bottom for a week or two until they win one, I guess," end quote. Isn't that great after all this time? Somebody still has to pull the old ball coach off Tennessee. I love it. Check this. If you found $100 on the street, would you pick it up or keep walking? Well, of course you take the money. So why do you keep picking winners without betting on them? This is why I go to my bookie, because it's fast, it's easy, and they pay when you win. Let's face it, where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. I would not be telling you all to bet with them if they were not the best. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet this football season, bet with MyBookie. Did you know you could bet on games after kickoff? If by the second half it looks like your bet is going to lose, you can always just take the other side. I do that, and it works. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings. And no matter how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of year. Join right now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. It's a great deal. Use the promo code Rome and activate that offer. Promo code Rome. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. He is Therese Paylor. Therese, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Jim. Thanks for the vine, man. I grew up listening to you as a teenager in Detroit. You're actually one of the reasons I decided to get into sports media, man. So it's an honor to be in the jungle, and I'm pumped to be here.
Therese, my man, that's really nice of you to say. I really appreciate that. I really appreciate hearing that, and I appreciate you. All right, so the Houston Texans had themselves a busy weekend. Let's go back. Yeah. What was your reaction when you heard about the Texans sending Jadeveon Clowney to Seattle for Barkevious Mingo, Jacob Martin, and a third-round pick?
Well, the initial reaction is John Snyder still has his fastball. Of course, that's the general manager of the Seattle Seahawks. I love the deal for Seattle. I know they're not going to – they promise not to franchise Clowney. I get it. But he's playing for money, and I've got a saying. The contract year in the NFL is undefeated. Clowney is a good football player. He's a great run defender, and he's above-average pass rusher. And I'm convinced we haven't seen his best pass rush season yet. But I bet you see it this year, because he's playing for money. So I like the deal for Seattle. I thought they gave up two used parts and a third-round pick for a player who's really going to help that defense this year. You know, they're trying to make the Super Bowl. You know, for Houston, it goes back to one big problem I have with those guys, and it's that they didn't trade this franchise player that they liked but didn't love before the draft. And you have to do that so that you make sure there's a market, number one, and B, if there are other teams who are interested in that player, you give them muffs to hammer out an extension with that player, right? But if you trade a franchise player after the July 15th deadline to do that, your return is going to be limited in what you can get. So there are some reasons they did it, and I can get into that if you want. But on the surface, that was the big problem I had with it. They didn't get rid of this guy they liked but didn't love in March or April, like the Chiefs and Seahawks did with Frank Clark and Dee Ford.
In fact, I was going to ask you about that. Therese Paylor is my guest, because they did not do exactly what you just said. They backed themselves into a corner. So when you compare how Seattle handled things with Frank Clark and how Houston handled things with Clowney, how much worse does it make Houston look?
It's bad. I mean, look, the Chiefs did the same thing with Dee Ford, you know? They got these guys out of here, and they got more than the third-round pick that Houston got for Clowney. So on the surface, you know, just dollar for dollar in a vacuum, that's a problem. Now, I get why they did the trade, because it's a weird deal. Like, the Clowney trade in a vacuum wasn't good for them, but if you take everything they did, it's kind of like they made a three-way trade, right? Like, it's kind of like they got better. Stills is going to help them on the outside. Laremy Tunsil is one of the best young tackles in football, and they've got him under club control for two more years. That's a good thing. You know, like, that helps him. That helps them this year. But the problem is they didn't maximize every piece of it, and that's why they've been getting killed.
All right, so they have Tunsil under contract, but at the same time, they gave up a lot to get him. Now, again, we understand why they did this, right? They've got to get some protection for Deshaun Watson, but because they did not get him to commit to a long-term contract, how much leverage does he have right now?
Well, he has some leverage, but he's under contract for 2 years, and then they can also franchise him after that. So, you know, he's going to be wanting to get paid too. And given what they've given up for this guy, like, they're going to be looking to pay him. He'll be the league's highest paid tackle. You know, I'm sure that that's something that's going to end up coming down the road, right? So, like, look, you'd rather, like, have it done, you know, as soon as possible. But, you know, I do think that if Houston makes that trade like they did, they're going to do it because they know they're going to be able to re-sign that guy when the time comes. So I'm actually going to give them the benefit of the doubt on that. You know, you can't give up all that capital, which I also think is a good trade for Miami, but you can't give up all that capital without getting that deal done. He will get signed at some point. And I do think, you know, this is going to be a trade that's going to help them for years down the line.
Therese Paylor joining us. All right, then, let me ask you this. LeSean McCoy signed with Kansas City over the weekend. Given the relationship between McCoy and Andy Reid, how do you like that fit for him and for the Kansas City offense?
I really like it. You know, watching some tape of McCoy last season. Look, he's not what he used to be. But how many of us are? You know, when we're 31, compared to when we were 25. You know, he still has the ability to kind of make people miss in a phone booth and in space. And I think his ability to catch the ball is really going to be helpful in Andy Reid's offense. I think the Chiefs are going to throw it around a lot. You know, I still think Damian Williams is the guy, but I think he's going to end up sharing it to a pretty decent degree with Shady McCoy. And the guy who really takes a back seat is Darwin Thompson. Now, he'll mix in a little bit, but, you know, my guess is it's a 60-40 split between Williams and McCoy, Williams getting the 60%. And McCoy's really going to help this team, though. You can't have enough depth at running back, and we know the Chiefs have a very dangerous offense. They're going to throw it a lot, including pass it to their backs, and Shady can still do all that. Even if he's not the all-pro player he used to be, he can still do all that and be a very good piece of what should be another killer offense by Andy Reid.
Therese Paylor making a jungle debut today. He joins us for a few more moments. Now, the Chargers reportedly were also interested in McCoy. You reported recently that Melvin Gordon's been given permission to seek a trade partner. How would you describe then the situation now between Gordon and the Chargers?
It's tepid. You know, whenever a team gives a player the ability to go seek out a trade, you know, it kind of says, hey, you know, go do what you want to do. Go do what you can do. We're betting that you can't. But all the player can do, if no one's really biting, is saying, okay, then I'm not coming. And that looks like where we're at right now. I got to be honest, Jim, I don't love it for the Chargers. You know, that was a team that went 12-4 last year. You know, we've had a lot of discussion about Melvin Gordon's contract. He makes them a better offense. I think we've kind of forgotten that. And look, the other backs on the roster are capable, but, you know, Melvin is a special player. He's a good player. But from a business perspective, I get what they're doing. He's had injury issues. You know, like, I get it. I get it. But I'm just talking about on the field in 2019.
Therese Paylor joins me once again. I want to finish what I started with him. Therese, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good. All right, so finish your thought on Gordon the Chargers. In fact, let me ask you this. If you had to predict, what is the most likely outcome? Does he play in week one? Does he continue to hold out, or is he traded?
My hunch is that he misses week one, and this could stretch for a little bit, unless something develops on the trade front that we aren't privy to yet.
We'll see about that. One more thought before you go. You spent some time with the Vikings earlier in camp. Mm-hmm. What was your sense as the vibe around that team and around Kirk Cousins in particular?
Yeah. Jim, 100%. They're putting their eggs in the Kirk Cousins is going to be better because of Gary Kubiak and play action basket. And it's not just Gary Kubiak. Kevin Stefanski is going to be a head coach in this league sooner rather than later. He just has the look of one. And I think him and Kubiak get along, and they both understand the importance of leaning on the run game and the play action. And a big part of that's going to be the first-round center, Garrett Bradbury. They talk about him in ways that remind me of the ways the Colts talked about Quentin Nelson last year, which is high praise, but it's true. they think the offensive line is going to be a lot better. They think they're going to run the heck out of the ball. They think Cook is going to have a huge season, and that's going to help Cousins because they're going to play action teams to death, and they're going to get. They think they can get more value on Cousins by playing to his strengths. So we're going to have to see if it works, but I do think that's a team that will certainly finish above 500 and be right in the mix to win the NFC North.
All right, so one quick follow. I hear what you're saying about that, but, you know, there's this rap about Cousins that's getting louder and louder, that he puts up good numbers, but he can't win big games and he can't beat good teams. When you talk to him about what people say he can't do, what was his response?
It was actually pretty classic. He said, you know, if people say I'm not Aaron Rodgers and they say I'm not Patrick Mahomes, you're right. I'm not those guys. I haven't done what those guys have done on tape. But he does get upset when people say what he can't do, and it's not true. And he doesn't think that just – and he thinks that just because he isn't Rodgers or Mahomes, he thinks that just because he's not those guys, that doesn't mean that he won't be able to lead the Vikings to the Super Bowl. So at the end of the day, we'll have to see.
He is a senior NFL writer for Yahoo. He is a Hall of Fame voter. He is the co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast. Therese Paylor making a jungle debut. Therese, great to have you on the show. Appreciate you, and I know that won't be the last time.
Thanks for the vine, Jim. Appreciate it, man.
You got it, man. Be good. Prepare for road trips. Before your travel begins, visit O'Reilly Auto Parts. Simple preventative maintenance before you go will ensure a safe journey. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Somehow I managed to get this far into this program and a conversation about week one of college football without laying out my entire thought on Danny Hugh Freeze Jr. Now, that's not because I didn't catch his act on Saturday night. It's because I needed some space to lay it out. Hey-o! Because as always, whenever you're talking about Hugh Freeze, there is a lot to talk about. And if there's a way that Hugh Freeze can embarrass himself, he is going to find that way. After all, this is a guy who lost his gig at Ole Miss for calling sex workers on a cell phone. No, wait, that's really not fair. Let me rephrase that. He was calling sex workers on his school-issued cell phone. And then when he got busted, he had the audacity to tell Yahoo he accidentally misdialed the number. Quote, I've got no idea, to be honest. I was in an 813 area code, and that was a 313 number. I think that might have been a misdial. I don't think there was even a conversation. There's nothing to it. End quote. As always, when in doubt, just go with the old accidentally dialed a sex worker excuse. When hasn't that worked? It happens. It happens to us all.
It happens to us all.
And then, when he couldn't get a new gig, he then had the audacity to show up at the Little Rock Touchdown Club last season and say that part of the reason nobody wanted to talk to him was the climate.
I think the climate in America the last year probably affects a lot of administrators' decision-making.
You mean that climate where schools don't want to get anywhere near some dope who used a company phone to call sex workers? Accidentally misdialed a sex number, a time, or 10, and lied about it? You mean that climate? If that's the climate you're talking about, Hugh, you nailed it. Because that wasn't some one-off, or a misdial, or a butt dial, or a butt FaceTime, or any other lie that you can conjure up to cover up that butt dial. Because according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, the university's investigation uncovered calls of a similar nature over the course of several years, often matching up with travel logs showing the coach's use of the school plane. The school said it examined his travel logs from peak recruiting times, often November, December, and January, when Freeze would travel out of state using the school plane and other public resources, end quote. You know, but if blaming it on the climate or global warming or anything other than you trying to get with sex workers works for you, then you just do you, Hugh. My only question is, what kind of a school would hire Hugh Freeze after all that? I mean, does such a school even exist? Not only does such a school exist, this is actually too good to be true, because that school is Liberty University. That's right, Liberty. the same Liberty that has an athletic director who happens to be Ian McCaw, the same guy who resigned in disgrace from Baylor after presiding over a sexual assault cover-up in the football program. So, if you're questioning how a faith-based university could hire Ian McCaw and Hugh Freeze, trust me, you are not the only one. Honestly, if I never had to talk about Hugh Freeze and Ian McCaw ever again, that'd be a really good thing, a great thing. Except Hugh simply will not allow it. Because for his first game at Liberty, Hugh Freeze coached from a hospital bed in the stadium. If that sounds weird, it was. And if that sounds embarrassing and stupid, that's Hugh Freeze. A couple of weeks back, this guy had surgery on his back for herniated disc and treatment for a staph infection. The initial plan was he would not coach that game because, you know, it'd be pretty idiotic and embarrassing to have the face of the program calling the game from a hospital bed. But when the face of the program is Hugh Freeze, how much more embarrassing can it get, really? Well, a lot. According to ESPN, they got Freeze and his hospital bed into the stadium. Then they shoved him into a booth in the press box and they cut a hole in the wall so he could see his coaches in the room next door. That gave the world images of Hugh Freeze in a hospital bed in the booth that became instant memes. Freeze said afterwards, quote, "Obviously, we could talk, and I was looking dead at them through the hole, but it wasn't the same. I was wearing my normal headset where I could flip back and forth between the offense and the defense, but not being able to talk to the officials and look my quarterbacks in the eye, it was just really, really different and really, really odd," end quote. Odd. Well, you think? Which part? Who was the idiot in a public setting who suggested they have the head coach coach from his hospital bed in the stadium? And how the hell was there not one person, hell, every person there to say, oh, hell no. This is the worst idea ever, ever. You do this? Somebody should have said, this is the worst idea ever, but if we do this, and I'm going to quit before we do, but if we do this, we better win by 7 touchdowns. And even then, it is still the worst idea ever. Look, I don't want to make light of his health condition. I'm not doing that. Because as he told ESPN, that staph infection was serious. Quote, "The doctors told me if it had been another 24 hours, that strand of bacteria could have gotten to my heart, and then I would have been fighting for my life," end quote. Let's be very, very clear about this. Don't get it twisted. I am not making light of his health conditions. I'm saying I've been thinking about it, and I really think that this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. You're sick. You could have died. Sit this one the hell out. Get rest. Get right. But instead, you embarrass yourself, your program, and your entire university by rolling your hospital bed right into the stadium. What a warrior. What an imbecile. Maybe the biggest look at me moment ever. Oh, but not according to Hugh. He said it had nothing to do with him. Everything to do with his team. Quote, "I'm sure some people out there probably think I was doing it for the attention, but I can promise you it's not that. It wasn't any fun, but it was important to me to be there for my players, my coaches, and all the people at Liberty who have done so much for me," end quote. In other words, no, that's no pub grab. Yeah. That's no pub grab, or the biggest pub grab ever. How embarrassed do you think his players were by that look? How many walked right up to that hospital bed to drop their letter of transfer onto it? Or tried to unplug whatever old Hugh was hooked up to? Oh, and back to this whole thing. If you're going to coach from the hospital bed, you better win by 7 touchdowns. And if you can't do that, you better at least win. And if you can't do that, you better at least score. And if you can't do that, well, now you are the proud owner of the worst look ever. Because nobody will ever be able to unsee you rolling into your own stadium in a hospital bed and having them carve a hole in the wall so you can talk to your coaches and then get shut out at home by Syracuse. 24-0. Win by 7. Win. Score. After all that, they got shut out. Man, you can't do that. You simply cannot do that. But I'm glad you did. John Smoltz. John, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Good to have you, John. So you're on the call for the Twins and the Red Sox tonight, tomorrow on MLB Network. If we had gone back to the start of the season, John, everybody would have expected the Red Sox to be playing meaningful games in September. But how surprised are you that the Twins are where they are right now?
Yeah, I think they're probably the most unappreciated story of the year. They don't get a whole lot of national attention other than they're setting records offensively with their home runs. But they've been resilient. You know, the Cleveland Indians made their run, tied them with the division about 2.5 weeks ago. And I tell you what, when you dive in, I have not seen the Minnesota Twins in person. I'm getting a good look at them this week. And diving into all the numbers and stats and videos, I mean, their offense is as good as anybody's. Their pitching staff's underappreciated. This is a very, very good baseball team. I know the focus in the American League has been on two primary teams, and rightfully so. The Houston Astros and New York Yankees are having special years, but I wouldn't want to match up and try to think that you have an advantage facing the Minnesota Twins, and any of those teams that have to face them in the first series are going to have their hands full. And I tell you what, they've done a nice job. First year manager, probably going to win Rookie of the Year. And, you know, the Twins are relevant again. And, you know, it's to show you, I mean, 1991 is a long time ago. I get it. But 1991, of course, when the Twins took us down, they had 140 home runs as a team. Now, I know we're in a different era and it's a different subject and it's all kinds of different reasonings. But they're going to hit over 300 home runs this year as a team. And they've got eight guys with 20 or more home runs. So they're not only can they hit home runs, but they don't strike out. That's a rare combination that we haven't seen in a long time. When you got that kind of power and the ability to put the ball in play, makes them doubly dangerous.
John Smoltz joining us. So not only do they hit home runs, John, as you point out, they broke the MLB single season record for home runs with a month to go in the season, and they don't strike out. They touched on this. Let me just follow up on it. Does their brand of baseball translate well to the postseason, or might scoring runs become a concern when they run into really good pitching in a series?
Well, yeah, I think anytime we haven't seen a team for the most part in a long time lead the league in home runs and win a World Series, but we haven't seen a team with this kind of combination of not striking out as much. Usually the strikeouts come with the homers. You know, Houston proved what you can do in 1 year when they eliminated, they went dead last in the most strikeouts in a year to the best and least amount of strikeouts. They won the World Series. All the team's recipes that have won World Series over the last few years usually put the ball in play. So, yeah, going up against elite pitching is going to be difficult for any team, but if you put more pressure on the opposing team by putting the ball in play, I think you can increase your chances of success. You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago when everyone talked about strikeouts didn't matter analytically, the analytics don't like to openly correct, but they've had to self-correct on strikeouts do matter, and you don't win championships with strikeouts in your lineup. So I think Minnesota's done a nice job. They've obviously increase their ability to hit the ball in the air, but they haven't sacrificed their strikeouts, which is really an amazing, amazing opportunity for their ball club if they continue to do that.
We're talking to Hall of Famer John Smoltz. Now, John, in terms of the Red Sox, obviously the season is not over until it's over, but they are 5.5 games out of a wild card spot. To you, does it feel like a team that can turn it around, go on a run, and steal a spot in the postseason?
You know, the resume and the history of last year certainly would tell you yes, but I just don't think they have the pitching right now. If you would have told me that Chris Sale and they were struggling but healthy, I'd say yes. I mean, it's a huge week. They've got the Twins and the Yankees, and the only way I look at and I'm sure the way they're looking at it, if you don't go at least 5-2 or 6-1, that's tough pressure to put on the last month of the season. So, yes, they've got a chance. They got to win 19 to 20 baseball games this year, this September, and hope that some of the teams in front of them aren't able to stay at that pace, because they got to jump too many teams. But playing the Yankees and the Twins, you're going to find out a lot this week about what the Boston Red Sox have left. Offensively, they can play with anybody. They can score 6-7 runs a game It's just the pitching that hasn't been able to rebound from last year's incredible run, and the injury prevention obviously hasn't been great.
John Smoltz, Hall of Famer, and working with MLB Network, joining us once again. John, what about the Yankees? I mean, they have survived injury after injury, yet they're tied for the best record in baseball. What do you make of the depth of this team and how they've overcome all this adversity?
It really is amazing. You know, if I had to play a little bit glass half empty, the only thing I would say that would concern me a little bit is if you get to the end of the year and your guys are all clicking, that's great. But when you add back some of these guys that have been on injuries and they come back, you know, how does that work in the flow of their offense that has been clicking with seemingly anybody they plug in? That has been a special year that Boston had last year. It didn't matter who they put in. It seemed like whoever they got big hits. They won the World Series that way. And it seems like New York could ride that through this year. The difference is New York's pitching is not close to what Boston's pitching was last year. So they're going to have to rely heavily on their bullpen. They're going to have to, in my opinion, because their offense is so good and the pressure to get to their pen is going to be so heavy on Aaron Boone, no matter what the score is come the fifth inning, unless a guy's throwing a no-hitter, I don't know how a starter goes past five for the New York Yankees. And I think the biggest thing is going to be if they can have shorter series, they have a chance to win it all. But if they go deep into series after series after series having to use their bullpen, I think it just makes it much more difficult for their offense to keep slugging and their bullpen to keep pitching. So if they get Paxton hot, who's been great the last four or five starts, and they get another pitcher hot, whether it's Mendoza or whether it's Domingo or whether it's even Severino is able to piece together three innings in a series a couple times. It's going to be interesting because the pressure to me on Aaron Boone with this special year is how quickly does he use his bullpen? Because that's what they basically made their strength of their club in their bullpen. And that's going to be a lot of pressure on Aaron Boone to not want to go to it as quickly as he can.
And Severino made that first rehab start on Sunday. He threw 33 pitches in a Triple-A game. We're talking to John Smoltz. John, so Justin Verlander throws his third career no-hitter on Sunday. Not only that, though, John, he leads the American League in innings and ERA. He's tied for the lead in wins. He's just behind Gerrit Cole for strikeouts. I mean, how do you explain the fact that this guy is still doing this at age 36?
Well, you know, in this age of everybody giving everything you have as a starting pitcher, this is a guy everyone should be looking at if you're a young pitcher. He knows how to pitch. He's survived two different eras, if you will. He's got gears. He's got a gift that he can, you know, rev it up when he needs to, but he pitches. And, yes, he's going to give up some home runs this year. He's given up a lot of solo home runs. But he knows how to elevate the top of the strike zone. He gets down to the bottom. He hits all four quadrants. And I don't know the luxury of the greatness of the pitchers we have today if they're going to be given the chance to do what Justin Verlander's done, both longevity and the ability to pitch, because they're being taught to just throw with their stuff and max effort. Justin Verlander's not a max effort. He is truly a freak with his mechanics and the release point that he throws. Love watching him pitch. But I can't help but say, if you're a young fireballer, if you're a guy with stuff, if you don't watch Justin Verlander and try to learn, I don't know how you can pitch 18, 15, 12 years in this game with max effort stuff all the time. He ended that game, I think, with a 96, 97 mile an hour fastball, which means you can't do that 1 through 9 maxing out and grunting. You've got to have cruising velocity. You got to have the ability to step it up when you need to and spin the baseball. And that's what he's done since he's gone to Houston, and he's been healthier. Everyone forgets he was coming off an injury plague season. Everyone was kind of writing off Justin Verlander as a guy who's fallen off the cliff. His velocity was down. He came back from an injury probably sooner than he should have, and you know the team was going in a different direction. Here he gets this rebirth, goes to Houston. They show him a couple things with his release point and his ability to throw his slider again, and it's lights out. I mean, it's 1-2 Verlander Cole like we haven't seen in a long time. So that's why the Houston Astros have such an advantage when you talk about a deep run because of their rotation.
We're talking to John Smoltz. So, John, one quick follow to that. If you look at that 1-2, Verlander, Cole, and then you add Zach Greinke, I mean, you were part of some absolutely nasty rotations. How does Houston's compare to the best ones that you were part of?
Well, you know, everyone gets all bent out of shape when I say, you know, they've got way better stuff than we'll ever have had. And it's the truth. If you'd align those guys up on a street ball and try to pick who would you pick between us and them, you're going to pick them. But we just proved over the course of time and consistency, and we were able to stay healthy, and we pitched in a different era. So it's really tough to compare, but it's not a comparison when it comes to stuff. Their stuff's just that much better. I mean, you're talking about guys who can throw four-seam fastballs in 96, 97, 98 and spin a breaking ball as good as anybody. And they couple it with command. It's not like the new age where you just throw it and you're going to get your high walks, homers, and strikeouts, three true outcomes. So, you know, from a consistency standpoint, you know, we were able to do it and do it well for a long time. And these guys, they just have made, you know, embarrassment of riches. And it's a credit to their organization for recognizing, you know, that they've gotten majority of their stud pitching on one team. And that's really what you've seen in this rebuild kind of haves and have-nots baseball, is teams have kind of put together a formula for success, and it seems to be on four teams rather than spread out around the league. You know, the Mets have, the Nationals, tremendous staffs. Of course, the Dodgers, Houston, Cleveland had put together a tremendous staff when you're talking about five guys. So, you know, Houston to me is still the team to beat. I know the New York Yankees are having an incredible season, and they're probably going to, you know, they could very well have the best record. But because of what Houston can do in their rotation and what you have to do to beat them, you're going to have to find a way to be very economical in the lack of contact that you're going to probably see. You know, when you're talking about 14 to 15 strikeouts, not every single time, but on average for the Houston Astros, they only have to cover 12 outs in the field.
Hmm.
So that's why missing bats, and that's why putting the ball in play. They have the best combination, I think, between the pitching strikeouts and hitter strikeouts, meaning they don't strike out as much as hitters, but they strike out the most as pitchers. That's a pretty good gap when you're putting together a chance to win, you know, a long run in a postseason.
He is a World Series champion, a Cy Young Award winner, an eight-time All-Star, a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame, and remember, John Smoltz will call tonight and tomorrow night's Twins at Red Sox game on MLB Network. Also, Friday's Yankees at Red Sox game on both Facebook Watch and MLB Network. John, great to have you back. I really appreciate that conversation. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Clones, what do we want when we're craving protein or need more energy? Not bars or sugary snacks or energy drinks. We want beef. Pure and simple. Where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your father's jerky. Shriveled, dry, and tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over real wood fire. It's tender and tasty, not tough. And why is it so good? Because Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for its relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef very seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein and comes in four great flavors to satisfy all your cravings. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality that you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you do not see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Let's go to Milwaukee, see what's going on. David in Milwaukee. It's good to have you, David. How are you?
Romy, how you doing, man?
Good, good, David. How about you? What's up?
Hey, man, I'm a free man. I just got to tell you something. You know, in prison, we run different kind of smack. But your takes on sports, the way you can round that off so we could understand it, dude, you got me through a prison bit. I went from around 94, 95, they got you on the local station up there, till around 2008 when I got moved to a lesser security. Dude, I listen to you every day. You got me through some deaths in my family. Like, a lot of stuff, man. Your takes on Brett Favre. You know, so many things. Just I've been waiting on hold to talk to you about. And, you know, the Plasky, when you guys were up in Green Bay for the championship game. I'll never forget that, man.
So, David, talk to me. Like, what are radio privileges like in prison? I mean, can you listen whenever you want? Are there certain times you can listen? Like, how did you dial into the jungle when you were in prison?
Well, you know, we get radios in there. We can buy radios from outlets. You know, your family can get you radios. I was bumping around AM one day. You know, I played the parlay tickets in the joint. You know, them cats run the gamble up there, too, so numbers were a game. You know, and I tuned into sports radio, and I caught you one day, and you were talking about, I believe it was a Green Bay-San Francisco game, and your take on it was so good that I just never stopped listening to you. So I caught you during the day, and I did my gambling at night. So, you know, I just found you. You were on AM, and, man, I rocked with you the whole prison bit.
So what's it like being on the outside now? How long have you been out?
I've been out 4 years. I did 23, man. I went in at 16. I came out at 39.
Wow.
I own a house. I'm my company's number one salesman. I had a son. I just got married.
Wow, that's something else. So you've certainly been rehabilitated. What do you sell?
I sell services for vehicles, preventative maintenance packages so that we can maintain your vehicle, you know, whether it's through oil changes, whether it's through transmissions, radiators, whatever you need done on your vehicle, I have a package to sell you.
All right, so what about the smack off? Did you get the smack off on the inside?
Oh, I was trying to remember all the names from the smack off, man, and I can't remember every name. I afraid he sticks out to me. The fella that always sounded like he had a nasal strip on. You know, some of the smack, I was listening to Smoltz talk, and I thought about the Glavin, the Maddox, the racist closer. So, you know, I go back to them days. You know, I go back to the Rat family. I go back to all of that with you, man.
You can
smack
wait.
Offs. I got everybody in prison to listen to you in Green Bay, Wisconsin. If they're up there right now, they're listening to you right now.
And they're hearing you, David. They're hearing you on the outside. You know, and I'm going to go to break, David. I appreciate you. I appreciate your thoughts. In honor of that phone call, I'm going to reset Plaschke on the way back. And I've been spending a lot of time in Wisconsin, and that's not going to change. That's quite a story,
man.
David.
Thank you. The Bears still suck. And you know what time it is Thursday?
What time?
Green Bay over Chicago Thursday. The Bears still suck. They know what's up down south on Thursday.
There you go. All right, David, appreciate it. Thanks so much. David in Milwaukee. Well, I know exactly what time it is on Thursday. Can't wait to see Aaron Rodgers. New look offense, new head coach. So he just said he did 23 years in prison. Found the show, listened to the show, respected my take on the matchups, would get down at night, he said, because there is some gambling that goes on in the joint, turned other inmates onto the show, and he was running down some old school stuff. Ever wonder where your family comes from? Of course, we all do. You can discover more about your family and learn about your own story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. Ancestry DNA is amazing. It gives you so much more than just the places you're from. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started, and it does so by using precise geographic detail and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time. You can follow how and why your family moved from place to place. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Only Ancestry can tell such a rich story with unique features that give a more complete picture about a person. You know, like events that shaped them, how they made a living, and what they excelled in. You can get all that. All you have to do is go to Ancestry.com/podcast right now and get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Again, Ancestry.com/podcast and get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/podcast. We are joined by Sean Elliott. Sean, great to have you on. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. So, Sean, it's been a couple of days since you beat Tennessee in their house. I know you're already focused on Furman, but if you could, can you take me back for a moment? What were you feeling before taking the field on Saturday?
You know, we had an exciting feeling. We thought there were some advantages that we could take into that ball game. One of the things that we were very, very pleased with our fall camp, we had incredible leadership in our off season. over our summer and into our fall camp. So we felt like we were in a good position. We felt like we had great leaders that were doing the right things with our football team. We had had a tremendous amount of success in our workouts and our strength conditioning program over the summer. And we were just really ready to go play, as a lot of people are that day. But we had a little bit different feeling.
You know, coming in, I was eager to talk to you about that leadership, and I will in just one moment. But there's a story that goes, a couple of weeks before Saturday's game, you wrote up on a whiteboard, quote, "Tennessee won't rush for 100 yards against us," end quote, and you signed your name to it. What did you know about your team that gave you that level of confidence?
Well, to tell you the truth, in our offseason, we really put the hammer down on us defensively. We were, a year ago, giving up a lot of rushing yards, and our defensive coordinator, Nate Fuqua, did an outstanding job, along with our staff, just tweaking the defense a little bit to ensure that we were going to do some things differently, and we were going to put some pressure. And during our fall camp, we had some struggles offensively moving the football against them on the ground. And I've seen it a lot over the course of the years, the type of defenses that we play here to go into a game like that, and their O-line have some struggles with communications and steps. So, I was sitting in the offensive staff meeting. I wasn't joking around, but I asked all of our staff guys. I was like, "Hey, I want to know your thoughts. So write it down, and we'll see what happens after the game." And I just threw it out there, and I said, "Put this up on the board." And I said, "Tennessee won't rush for 100 yards." And Simon Name walked out, and had an employee, a staff member, come up to me. He said, "Tennessee rushed for 93 yards, coach." I said, "You got to be kidding me." And we got a really good laugh out of it, and it was funny. I guess it was a fun prediction or premonition, but it turned out to be great that we could go in there and do that.
Sean Elliott joining us. You know, it's kind of a funny thing, but there's more to it than that, right? As an example, your quarterback Dan Ellington said of you, quote, "Coach Elliott is a straight-up guy. He's not going to blow smoke up your butt," end quote. So how valuable is it to have a relationship like that with your players, to know that they've got that level of trust and confidence in you and your vision and your culture?
Well, I think without a doubt that speaks volumes. And I think, we here as a staff and our players, we all have a great relationship. I certainly can go into a team meeting and speak my mind, and some things become personal, but they can come to me and do the exact same thing. And, We don't sugarcoat anything. When we go out and we have a great practice, I really push that, to let them know exactly how we practice. But when things aren't going bad, I mean, it's straight to the point. So that open relationship is very, very key. I mean, guys, they walk in and out of these offices. We talk about so many other things than just the game of football. But ultimately, I think the communication with player and coach has got to be open-ended. And sometimes you got to let those players say some tough things back to you. So we have that option here at Georgia State.
Georgia State head football coach Sean Elliott joining us after a huge win. Now, when you mention your leadership, you got to start with a guy like Ellington. He's got his own confidence about him, right? He said that he felt like in previous years, guys might have just been happy to be in a game like that, but he wanted to make sure that everybody stayed really aggressive against Tennessee and that they weren't just happy to be there. How important is it to have a leader like him?
Yeah, anytime you have a leader, especially at that quarterback position, that has great confidence and a skill set that goes along with those talents, it's amazing. I mean, it's truly amazing. Dan, and we've got several leaders that are just like him, but he comes to practice. He loves to practice. He loves to study the game of football. He loves to interact with us coaches. I mean, you talk about open relationships. I mean, we have some great conversations about so many other things than football, but what a phenomenal leader he is. He exudes confidence because he has studied the game and he knows he's prepared going into the game. So that helps with the leadership, and guys trust him. When I say trust, they truly trust that young man right there. And I'm just thrilled to death that he had the day that he did and led our football team to the victory there in Knoxville.
You know, such a big, big win in Knoxville, but as big as Saturday's win was, is that the biggest in school's history, or does that bowl win back in 2017, where you're holding up a trophy, feel even more significant than beating Tennessee?
You know, I so many people have asked me that, and for myself personally, I always look back to that first bowl win. What a tremendous honor to play in the postseason, get that first bowl win, to hoist the trophy that means something. You know, nobody's given us anything for beating Tennessee. You know, in 2 or 3 weeks, it'll probably be forgotten. And depending on how this season goes, I mean, it could totally go another direction. But to hoist that trophy, to have a bowl win that really just speaks volumes of how the season had went, is truly phenomenal. And that's one of the proudest moments I'll have in my coaching career, is hoisting that trophy for the AutoNation Cure Bowl back in 2017. Because I just understood what those seniors meant, and to see it all come to an end, the last game of the season, and to call us, you know, the quote-unquote champions of the Cure Bowl, that was very, very special.
We're talking Georgia State football head coach Sean Elliott, my guest for a few more moments. Of course, you played your college ball at App State, and you coached there for more than a decade. You were a part of some incredible moments, including that win over Michigan. So what makes App State so special, and then what did you take away from that experience that you've applied at Georgia State?
Well, you know, the people make every place special. I mean, that's ultimately what makes programs special. It's the coaching, it's the players, it's the relationships. And, you know, back during that era at Appalachian State, we had just rolled a couple of national championships and then headed into Ann Arbor to play a Michigan football team with kind of the same confidence that we had in Knoxville last Saturday. But, you know, like I said, what makes it special, and just like our win Saturday, is the guys like Dan Ellington. It's the guys like Ed Kearney, our linebacker. You know, just so many people, the experiences that you've gone through, the suffering that you've gone through, and then to see it all come and to come out on top the way we did, that's what makes it unforgettable. It really does.
All right, so if it's about the people and the relationships, I've got to ask you about Steve Spurrier, who you coached with in South Carolina. I know how excited he was about your win Saturday over Tennessee. What was it like to work with him, and what did you learn from him?
I tell you what, working with Coach Spurrier was probably one of the most enjoyable times of my career. I mean, I call it the best times of my life, and that's not taking anything away from working for Jerry Moore at Appalachian State or Will Muschamp that year that I worked for him. But, God, we just enjoyed the game of football. We loved it. I mean, we were very, very competitive, but we just really had a great time in game planning. Our staff conversations, it was just unreal to work with him. And what a creative mind. One of the most competitive individuals that I know. His creative mind was something that I would just be shell-shocked, because, you know, he would come up with this idea, and next thing you know, I mean, it was exactly the way he'd seen it or envisioned it, and it would work on Saturday, and the play calling. But, you know, Coach Spurrier taught me so much in my coaching career about how to handle a staff and family and all those types of things. It's truly an honor to work for a man, a legend. And, you know, I work for two Hall of Fame coaches, and Jerry Moore and Steve Spurrier. So I've taken a lot from those guys over my years with them.
Georgia State head coach Sean Elliott joining us. One last thought for you. You know, there's this thought about the program that it could be a great place to take guys who don't work out at an SEC school, and then you can reach for that quick fix, but that's not what you've done. So why is that, and how important is it to you to get guys, coach guys that you recruited, and then develop a relationship with them over a longer period of time?
I just think in this day and age, it's so critical to really find out the true meaning of who someone is and develop a relationship. I mean, see if they've got the leadership qualities to make your team special. See if they've got the work ethic, you know, their academics. I think, you know, if you truly want to build a special football program, it's built over time. It's not built with a lot of quick fixes. You know, I've said that we don't go out really searching for the quick fix. But, you know, there's a lot of situations where we have taken guys to come in here and help us out. But we do our studying. I mean, we certainly do. And that's critical in this day and age, because I think so many programs just are willing to take the talented athlete, the guy that they can get them to win the quickest. And sometimes that's not always the best case. So we're going to try to build it from the bottom up. We're going to try to build it with a good, solid foundation and freshman recruiting and go out there and, like I said, I think time is essential to building something great. And having all that time with a true freshman through a senior year is really, really special.
He is the head football coach at Georgia State. They're coming off that huge win over Tennessee on Saturday, 38-30 in Knoxville. Next up, Furman, Saturday night. Sean Elliott, the head coach. Sean, thank you so much. Congrats on the win, and really nice to visit with you.
I really appreciate it being on, man. It was a great day for Georgia State University, the city of Atlanta, and our football program, and we appreciate everything you do. Thanks for having us on.
Appreciate you, Coach.
Good night now!